Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Gay Mormon Stories. We have a great podcast ready to go for you on this fine morning. Speaking here from the Midwest outside of Chicago, Illinois. And we have a wonderful guest on the program today. We have Peter Vandervelde, and he is from South Africa. Peter Vandervelde.
The first time was better.
I'm falling apart here, but
it's all good.
We are so happy to have you, my friend. It's great to hear your voice. Thank you for taking the time all the way in South Africa to speak with us and our listeners here. Thank you so much, Peter.
No, thank you, sir. If I say the tables should actually be turned, I should be interviewing you. You've been a bit of a hero to me ever since I saw a clip you did speaking out for marriage equality during the Prop 8 thing that you had going down over there.
Well, thank you. Thanks. Hopefully you were able to hear a few words amidst the sobbing and crying. That's very kind of you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about your story. Now, you are 33 years old as of a few days ago. Happy birthday, Peter.
Thank you. It's all downhill from here, you know.
not quite. No, 33 is quite good compared to my 42. So I think you're doing okay.
Yeah, in straight years, that's a lot older, though.
Gotcha. I learn new things all the time on this podcast and my journey as an ally, so I had no idea that we were on a different chronological.
Yeah, they say 30 is the sell-by date in the general subculture.
So you're a gay man in South Africa, and one of the really interesting things, other than just having the opportunity to speak with someone from South Africa, is that you are not a member of the church. You are currently not a member of the church. Is that right?
I am not a member of the LDS now. I've never been a member of the LDS.
So, but you are interested in the LDS church? You're interested in Mormonism?
I identify as a Mormon, but I'm not a member of the church. And that's probably a little complicated, and then there's quite a long history as to how exactly that came about. But I do view the Book of Mormon as the cornerstone of my religious faith. It is the book that got me to pray after many years of not praying. It was the first thing that really opened a door to contact with the divine or an experience of the divine in my life. And ever since then, I've viewed the Book of Mormon as true and Joseph Smith as a prophet. Certainly was to me. Without Joseph Smith, I would not believe in God. Without the Book of Mormon, I would not believe in God. And I converted to Mormonism in my life. I can unfortunately not join the church, as someone like me is a bit too outspoken and maybe too open about who and what I am. I've been gay long before I was Mormon, and I just don't think that will fly very well in the church. I know there are some welcoming wards, but that's not the case necessarily all around the world.
Okay, so have you visited a Mormon church? Have you gone to meetings, sacrament meeting and such?
I've been to two meetings here in South Africa. I went to the Randburg branch ward, as you would you would call it. And I've went to the Ridderpoort building once, and the experience of it was not that bad. It was actually quite pleasant. It's just that when I can fly under the radar, that's good. You know, I think when I become vocal about who I am or if people recognize me, it might not be as pleasant.
Okay. So that's a great setup. So we'll kind of get into more of the details of how you discovered Mormonism and the church a little bit later on. But first, I want to kind of get a little bit of your backstory, maybe share with our listeners, you know, your background, your history, and maybe a little bit of your family history, I think, would be really interesting with South Africa.
Okay, that's very cool. Now I'm what they call Afrikaans. The Afrikaans people, of course, were the people that used to run the entire show in South Africa during apartheid.
And are they Afrikaans? Are they kind of a mixture of Dutch colonists? Are they from the Netherlands?
Or? It's mainly Dutch, although there's a lot of French Huguenot influence. In the Afrikaans people, there's also a lot of German.
Okay.
There's even some Portuguese and Italian that kind of over the years kind of intermingled as well into the whole Afrikaans melting pot, which makes it pretty interesting that they tended to think of themselves, or we tended to think of ourselves, as the master race back in apartheid days. You know, it's actually quite weird because it is this group of people that came from all over. And yet they kind of had this ideology of racial purity, which was very weird, of course, before democracy came to South Africa. And I grew up in that culture. I was raised to think of myself as racially superior, and that my religion was superior, and that my language was superior. And, of course, then there was the rude awakening when everything changed, and the Afrikaner has changed a lot. There's been a lot of soul-searching as a people, but that's a side issue, I guess. So I was raised in...
What is the Afrikaans' predominant religion, just out of curiosity?
It's Calvinist. It's Calvinist. And I was raised in that. There's really three, they call them the three sister churches. It's Dutch Reformed. But when you speak of the Dutch Reformed Church today, you might be alluding to the church in Holland, which is relatively progressive. So there's the Dutch Reformed Church, but there's really three branches to that. There's what they call the Hervormde Church and the Gereformeerde Church, and it has all these lovely R sounds in Afrikaans. I was raised in the Hervormde Church, okay. So it's one of the Calvinist branches.
Okay, so predominantly a Calvinist tradition.
Predominantly, there are some evangelicals around, and I think that has grown. The churches have lost a lot of influence and membership since the fall of apartheid. The church was actually instrumental in the apartheid philosophy here. I mean, they viewed apartheid as something that is divinely sanctioned. In fact, to this day, there are some groups within some of the Afrikaans churches that refuse to let go of the idea that apartheid is something that's segregation, is something that's divinely sanctioned. But when I grew up, the democracy came to South Africa in 1994. I was born in 1980. So I grew up reading in Sunday school what a blessing I would be to my family if I did my military service. And no, we got it. We got it bad. We had a relatively complete indoctrination growing up, and it's interesting to see how, you know, things can be eternally true and how things can change. Just a few short years ago, you know, I was told that it will be it will be a cold day in hell. You know, that there would be racial equality in this country, and it would never happen. Well, you know, never turns out to be quite a long time, and I suppose I'm a bit cruel in taking pleasure in that.
Yeah, well, yeah, we all hear these absolute statements about certain things, and then as time progresses, things really do change, don't they?
And sometimes a lot quicker than never.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, tell us a little bit about your, just briefly about your ancestry and your family history and your parents.
Okay, well, my dad is a car salesman and my mom is a nurse. They split up about 3 years after having me. And then I went to go live with my father. And okay, my father's people are Dutch, mainly. They are what we call the Dorslandtrekkers. They the thirst land pioneers, I suppose. They moved between Namibia, Angola, and South Africa. My father was born in Namibia. I was born in Klerksdorp, which is this small mining town here in SA. My mom's people were more German. There was a strong German side to the family. And yeah, they had me. They gave that one look and said, we're not doing this again. Split up. I went to live with my father. And then during the school holidays, which is four times a year, the way it runs in South Africa is there's four school terms and four holidays in between. And I would spend holidays at my mom's place, and during school terms, I was with my dad. Both of them moved around a lot, so I was very lucky in that I saw large parts of the country growing up. I've pretty much lived everywhere. There's a place in South Africa I've been there, so it was pretty fun. So they were kind of what I would call middle class. Growing up in the 1980s, the lifestyle was very similar to what I'd imagine it would be like growing up in the U.S. You live in the suburbs, your dad works, your mom either works or is a homemaker. You watch a lot of TV. You know, it's a very middle-class, suburban kind of lifestyle. And that was the experience when I was a child.
Great. So tell us about what school is like in South Africa as you were growing up. I'm assuming it was segregated, right?
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, yeah. Apartheid was an interesting thing. Apartheid was about more than just racial segregation. You know, it's not enough to be white. You should be a white Calvinist male. Then you're okay. Everything else is somewhat suspect and probably communist.
Okay, so
it was a very firm kind of view of the world. And I had the pleasure of being born as one of these white Christian males.
You are at the top of the mountain, basically.
I'm part of the chosen race, the chosen people, and things were going to be wonderful.
Chosen race, chosen gender, and
there
chosen
we go.
Religion.
And it would have been all wonderful had it been not for my unchosen homosexuality.
There's your record, huh?
Yeah, there we go. That was that surfaced relatively early with me. I started being aware that I was different from others very, very early on. My first memory of realizing that I'm different from the others was when I was 4 years old.
Wow.
I went to a birthday party of one of the girls, a neighbor, and she was beautiful. She was dressed up like a little princess, and I mean, she had the crown on and everything was wonderful, and she was seated at the table. And I remember looking at her and going, nah, but looking to the left and going, oh, but what do we have over here? It was pre-sexual. I mean, I don't think you have a sexual identity at that age. But I realized that there is a kind of a warmth and attraction to the other little boys, not to the girls. There was something magical about boys that didn't exist with girls, for me, of course. So that was my first memory of being different from the others. I realized I was different. And it was not sexual, but I realized that I'm different from the other kids. And I also realized that this is bad. Almost instantly, I knew that I'm different from the others, and that's bad.
Okay. So immediately, and this is very common, of course, with folks who are gay or transgender, they internalize that difference and they label it as being a negative. They realize, they recognize it as being a bad thing. And can you give us a little bit of a cultural context for South Africa with regards to being gay? Was it, you know, in the 80s, pretty much growing up, was it fairly similar to how it was in the United States and in other countries, would you say?
For the Afrikaans people, yes. I mean, despite these weird religious, political ideologies that Afrikaners had, Afrikaners are most similar to Americans, Europeans, Australians. When you ask me about South African culture, I'll have to specify that what I'm talking about is Afrikaans culture, because it's very different in Zulu culture or Xhosa culture or Tswana culture or Sotho culture. I mean, there's a lot of tribes in South Africa, and I'm specifically speaking about the experience of being Afrikaans.
Okay.
And at the time, that tribal division was absolute and total. These days, there's a lot more, you know, learning from other cultures, cooperating with other cultures. There is a South African identity. Back then, there wasn't. You were Afrikaans, or you were black.
Okay.
Or you could have been English, and the English aren't really, you know, I mean, they're almost black. So that's the way it was perceived by the people back then. So yeah, there's a macho thing to the culture. I mean, it's Puritan. It's macho. It's very stern. It's very stoic. You're expected to be strong. And homosexuality is something that you find amongst communists and Satanists and things like that. It's not something that normal people are. That was the prevailing viewpoint at the time.
Just out of curiosity, how would the black tribes in South Africa, the Zulu folks and the other tribes, how did they view homosexuality?
That's quite a sensitive question, because I don't like speaking on behalf of other people. What we find today is that your various ethnic tribes are less tolerant of homosexuals than are white people in this country generally, especially among the poor areas. And I think that's a function, that's a socioeconomic function rather than a racial or a cultural function. The black cultures in South Africa are also quite set in their ways of, well, this is male and this is female. But that is on what is said openly. As with the Afrikaners, there's always been an amount of homosexuality. So there was a homosexual tradition amongst migrant workers, for example, who would come from what was then called the homelands into the mines and work on the mines. There were homosexual or same-sex relationships, rather, that took place amongst them. And there were some colored communities, for example, that had drag queens and gay clubs and things as early as the 1920s. But as a general thing, African culture is pretty stern about being gay not being okay.
Okay.
And that's generally. And I mean, that really is generally, because you can't pronounce that a people is like this. You can't generalize like that. But generally, the cultures tend to be fairly conservative.
Okay. All right. So Afrikaans, you're definitely in school growing up, and you are separated, and
you grow up in
school.
You're in a system that's called Christian National Education.
Okay, so it's religious education that you almost received there.
Oh, absolutely. No.
Okay.
There should be no separation between church and state for us, because, you know, we're the
uh-huh.
people. So you
get
the church is instrumental in the church was instrumental in apartheid. I mean, they justified it, they recommended it, they said it was the word of God, they encouraged it, it was taught from the pulpits. It was you were expected to go to church. It was a very all-encompassing ideology, apartheid. It was very, very much about religion as well as state and race. It was very much about that. So you grow up and there's the macho culture, which prohibits the homosexuality. There's the religious thing that teaches you that it's wrong. But I think this is similar for a lot of people. You kind of realize the secret about yourself, and then you keep it a secret, and then you kind of grow up in isolation. You're never socialized. Your dad doesn't take you fishing and say, son, the thing about dating men is, you know, you don't. It's, you're never socialized to be a homosexual because you are necessarily the product of some sort of heterosexual union. And so you are very much isolated. It's alone on a level that's more than just, you know, I don't think I'm going to find someone. It's alone on the level of, I don't think there's anyone like me. I remember being about like 10 when it, 10, 11 and around there, where I actually thought that I might be the only one. I might be the first homosexual. I mean, I didn't have the term homosexual, but this might be the first time in history that there is something as twisted as myself. You really internalize that stuff and you hear it from everywhere. So yeah, I mean, and as far as the school goes, you know, just to show in biology, we were taught about how the black races were inferior to the white race. That would be part of the biology curriculum back then. Yeah. So it was a very, very, it was the Twilight Zone. It's weird. It was like Mars. It was crazy.
So what was it like, you know, growing up with your peers, you know, friends and things like that at school?
Once you accept this whole weird ideology that we grew up in as the norm and you're not exposed to anything else, once you've done that, your childhood is very much like any other childhood because you don't question it. So your childhood is very much hanging out with friends, getting on a skateboard, going swimming at the lake, renting VHS movies and watching far too many movies. It was a fun being a boy kind of growing up culture. And it was all very good until such time as I kind of started developing in different ways, and I started realizing that I really, really, really liked some of my friends, and that just became awkward then. So that was pretty difficult. I think I had a lot of crushes once I kind of hit the teenage years.
Did any of your friends sense your orientation?
No.
You hit it very well.
It's not just hiding it. I don't think that your behavior necessarily gives you away. Myself, I'm one of what they call, I hate the term, but they call it straight acting. I hate the term. But I guess, you know, no one would think I could pass. And I was always like that. I was always into boy things. You know, I liked martial arts and I liked hiking and I liked boxing. And I liked jogging. And, you know, I was one of those, I was probably a jock a bit in school. And
well, that must make me gay acting because I hate all that stuff.
Well, there you go, you know. It's funny how the stereotypes work. It's funny how the stereotypes, it's big. But if I had to tell one of them, I think very early on now, I'm talking about before I hit 14, because I did come out at age 14.
You came out at age 14?
Yes, sir.
To your parents?
No. Well, to them as well, and to everyone. I came out at age 14.
Wow, that's you know, when you're talking about the Afrikaans culture, I'm a little surprised that you could come out so early, or that you chose to come out so early. Tell us more about that.
At the time, it was pretty bad, I have to tell you. I got kicked out of my home. I had to leave home, and I did. My dad and I actually had a fist fight.
Back up a little bit here, because I want to hear the decision-making.
I was angry.
In your mind, how did you come to the decision to come out?
I had a argument with my father, who I think on some level realized that in particular there was this one friend that I was a little too close to, and my father kind of verbally attacked him, and I got so angry that I fought back. And as I fought back, my dad took it up a notch. And so I took it up a notch because I was just so angry with him. And I was angry with not just him, I think, but it definitely was directed at him at the time. I was so angry with everything that I came out to him in the middle of an argument. It was physical. And I left home. And then 2 days later, I was back at school because I first had to figure out where I'm going to sleep and where I'm going to live. And when I got back to school, I came out there as well. So I was out. Wow. I was out to everyone. And I was angry as hell.
What were the responses of various people, teachers, your peers? How did various people respond to this?
Bear in mind that at that time, this entire apartheid system just ended.
What year is this when you came out?
94.
1994. So yeah. This is really – the juxtaposition of this is really amazing because – as the walls of apartheid are coming down,
I'm free.
Yeah,
what it was. It coincided with the cultural shift.
Yeah, that's amazing to me. You know, the walls of separation with regards to your orientation and keeping that hidden and keeping that secret are also crumbling.
Right. And I think it might have actually played a role, you know. It might have actually been part of it, and in a lot of ways, you cannot be that repressed and that oppressed, and not fight back. And so, by the time I came out, of course, these walls were coming down, and on a societal level, there was too much confusion to really hurt me the way they might have hurt me. Had it been a few years earlier.
Oh, that's interesting. So apartheid collapsing actually kind of shifted the focus there. It was so monumental.
We got bigger things to worry about than gay kids.
Yeah, you know, Peter's gay. Yeah. Well, hey, look what else is going on over here. I mean, the whole, whole world is completely transforming.
So there was a bit of that. And on the more personal level, what are you going to do? I'm gay. What are you going to do? Beat me up? I'm the tough guy. So what are you going to do? I just had a fist fight with my dad, which I won. I'm 14 years old. I live by myself. Okay. I'm taking care of myself. I'm putting myself through school. I'm angry as hell. I'm strong. And that's where I found myself from then on.
Where did you live? How are you taking care of yourself?
I found the sister of a friend. I rented from her. It was 600 rands for a month. I still remember that, which is not a lot of money. It was kind of a special deal for me. I paid her. I worked at a restaurant in the evenings. So I started as a clown on weekends. The Friday night, the Saturday night shifts, and then the Sunday double shift. And that was a couple of bucks. That was enough to pay 600 rands worth of rent and get me food throughout the week. I also ate at the restaurant. Then I graduated to waiter and made good money for a kid my size. So I worked as a waiter. Started as a clown, upgraded to a waiter, did pretty well, ate at the restaurant, went to school in the days, worked at night. It was fine.
Wow.
It was actually pretty cool. I mean, I thinking back, I mean, I was so close. I was so vulnerable. I mean, everything in my life was so close to, you know, there's no safety net. But at the time, I didn't see it as that. At the time, I was just so angry that nothing else could penetrate. I was driven by my anger. I was fueled by my anger. And I was angry. I was really angry for a very, very long time.
Was the anger, it sounds like in some ways it wasn't, was it self-directed? Were you angry at yourself that you were gay, or were you angry at God, or are you angry at?
By the time I reached 14, I no longer internalized disapproval, the homophobia, the hatred. By the time I hit 14, I was convinced that I was okay the way I was, and I was angry with the rest of the world. Which was pretty much everyone. Okay. It was me against the world. Okay. And as for as long as I can remember, I was told that there is something fundamentally wrong with me. And you know what? There wasn't. So now I felt very, very self-righteous. But all these years you've been saying to me that, one, apartheid is the truth. Two, there's something fundamentally wrong with me. All these years you've said these things to me. Why would I believe a word that comes out of your mouth? I was angry. And that anger pretty much drove me and ran me, well, all the way until the end of high school.
Okay, so 14 years old, the pivotal time here in your life, you are on your own, and apartheid is crumbling, and you are working on being self-sufficient and being on your own. You've stood up to your father. You actually beat him in a fight, and
he hit first.
He hit. Okay, the record here.
Yeah, no. And you know what? I think it is important. I think it is important. I don't think you can indefinitely push people around and not expect and be surprised people push back. So I think that's an important distinction.
No, it is. And the reality, too, is that you had so many strengths, determination to be able to do this. I mean, really quite amazing that you were able to stand up for yourself and then shed the internalized homophobia, get rid of that, say, hey, you know, I'm accepting myself and the rest of the world is wrong about me, and I'm going to go out there and I'm going to live my life. So where do you kind of go from there after 14 and after your country is transformed?
You know, the thing is, it's an ongoing transformation. And while it's a nice breaking free from the oppression, you're not okay yet. It's not good to be that angry. But, you know, at the time, I didn't care. I was just driven, and it was cool. Went to school during the day. Some of the nights, I went to work at the restaurant, and I was going to, I don't know what, but I was going to be okay because I was going to show them. So I finished my high school career, taking care of myself, and got a little worried because, you know, it's very hard to afford college tuition or anything like that. There's no support. So I was very worried about what I was going to do with my life. I always wanted to be a writer. I remember growing up, I wanted to be Stephen King. Stephen King was my thing. I wanted to be Stephen King. I loved reading his stuff. It was a subversive act to read this kind of literature. And it was always good fun for me to read it, and I was so amazed by how he played with words, but I never thought I could actually write for a living.
What were some of your favorite Stephen King novels?
Oh, man. The very first one I read was Cujo. I like that. And then I read Christine, and I read It, and I read The Stand, and I read Needful Things, and I was a Stephen King fanatic. At one stage, I was reading nothing but Stephen King. It was crazy.
Were you able to sleep at night, Peter?
You know, he never really scared me that much.
Okay.
It was just that his voice, that stream of consciousness thing that he does that so well. It's like he's in your head. It's like you're speaking to a familiar voice, to a friend. And that's what I loved about it, more so than the scary parts. You know, I was a little scared here and there in Cujo and in Misery. But to be honest with you, I don't think that anything a horror writer can come up with can scare me more than, you know, the world around me. You're told all your life that you're this kind of Calvinist ideal, and there's a lot of scary things that happen in South Africa in those days. I mean, it happened very peacefully, but all your life you've been warned about how you will be slaughtered en masse if those people ever got the chance. So you kind of get raised with these fears and whatever. So, you know, the Stephen King don't scare me. There are worse things than Stephen King. And growing up in South Africa is a very, very tough, even today, it's a pretty violent country. We do have some problem with violence here. It's a very violent country. I mean, we had 44,000 people murdered last year. That's 44 a day. Sorry, 16,000. 16,000 people, 44 people a day, 16,000 people murdered last year. And that was an improvement on the year before.
Wow.
It's a violent society. And look, it's also not all the time and to everyone. But I don't have a single friend who's not been mugged or robbed or burgled once.
Wow.
Not one.
Okay.
Yeah. And yet it's not like, you know, we're all walking around and it's like a war zone, you know. It's a great country, but there is a lot of violence.
Okay.
And especially towards LGBT people, and especially in places like townships, much more so than in the suburbs. Today in South Africa, as a nice rich white boy from the northern suburbs of Joburg, I'm okay. No one's ever picked on me since democracy. No one's ever tried to deny me my rights or my equality. But if I'm a black lesbian living in a township, my life is different. I mean, we have this thing, this phenomenon over here called corrective rape, where a group of men would rape a lesbian to cure her of being a lesbian.
Oh.
She would then go to the police, report the crime, and be laughed at, and nothing would happen. I mean, so on the one hand, you've got this incredibly progressive constitution of a democratic South Africa, and that is wonderful. You know, in some ways, it is more liberal, it is more liberated than the U.S. Constitution on this matter. You guys don't have marriage equality. And even in the states where you can marry, that is not federally recognized.
Right.
Whereas here in South Africa, there is marriage equality, full stop. And that's wonderful. But if a law exists only on a piece of paper and it's not in the hearts and the minds of the people, if they cannot access those laws, then to be honest with you, those laws aren't worth the paper they're printed on.
And
it's good for me.
And
it's not good for me.
Your point is that it really has to do with socioeconomic status, mostly economic status, that the wealthier you are, the more protection and access you have to the laws, whereas...
And not necessarily, there is some corruption and things like that, but it's not just because of that. It's because of the simple fact that people with money have options. If I have options and I can send my kid to a good school and I can get an education and I can learn about things like secular humanism and I can learn about things like, philosophy and I can learn about things like separation of church and state and I can learn about history and I can learn about sociology, then yes, my environment is necessarily a nicer place to be if I'm gay or if I'm straight. But if I'm living in a shack and I can't even read, and my parents can't read, and the influences that I do have comes from the religious right funding missions in Africa, like they did in Uganda, then my life is not that nice.
When you talk about the religious right, I want to get into this. I mean, are these foreign folks, like from the United States, that come in and try to stir things up a little bit, or is it religious right folks who are Afrikaners, or is it all of the above?
All of the above. Look, the United States sends a lot of homophobia abroad. It exports a lot of homophobia through religion, specifically through religion. What happens in American religion affects people elsewhere, but it is not a let's blame the Americans for exporting this kind of thing. My own people were pretty were pretty terrible with the religions that they exported. Homophobic, right-wing, bigoted religion, as opposed to other religion, has devastating consequences, especially to people who have nothing else. If all I have is my little church, if that is the one bit of education, access to books, to a kind of artistic tradition, to a intellectual tradition, if that is all I have, and that could be Roman Catholic, you know. And in the third world or the emerging world, the developing world, they tend to be more conservative than, say, Catholics who are for marriage equality, who live in Des Moines, Iowa. You know, that's one sort of Catholic. But if you're a Catholic living in a shack, what the Pope says about homosexuals has a very big impact on you, a real impact on you. It could kill you.
Yeah.
It's a lot more serious when you don't have money. You don't have options.
Yeah.
So that's why religion, you know, the religion has not been using its influence very responsibly.
let's segue with that into how did you come to find out about the church? What was your first understanding of Mormonism? What were your thoughts and beliefs about Mormonism and that sort of thing?
Okay, that is quite a long story. When I came out and this thing happened when I was 14, I decided, well, now that I've given up my family and I've given up my, you know, race, let me give up my God. I never believed in him anyway. Church was boring. I didn't like the character of this thing that they presented to me from the Bible. I didn't like what he was about, and I wanted to have nothing to do with him. And at the same time, I wanted to go and explore what's out there. So my first port of call was Buddhism. And I learned a great deal about the world. And Buddhism was one of the big things that really helped heal me as I went through my high school career. It got me from being very angry to eventually being okay and giving up anger. But after Buddhism, I actually tried a lot more. I kind of went on a bit of a, let's call it a religious tour de force, where I would convert to something for 3 months, see it from the inside out, and then get it out of my system, learn what there is to learn, and move on. So, I mean, I did spend time in a monastery, in a Buddhist monastery for 3 months, Chinese Buddhism. Chan Fo Guangshan has a group from Taiwan, has a huge temple they built in a town called Bronkhorstspruit here in South Africa. So I spent some time there learning about Chinese culture and Buddhism. And then I did the whole Judaism thing, hanging out with a lot of Jewish people and being in the shul and you know, going there and learning what that's about. And there was Islam and there was Hinduism, and then there was the Rastafarians, spent some time around them. And then, I pretty much tried everything, just looking for some sort of truth, and I never found it. And Mormon...
You tried everything on the religious buffet table there.
Pretty much. Well, there was Wicca, there was... you name it.
Wow.
I pretty much tried it. I pretty much went, giving myself a relatively good religious education, I would say. And the thing is, I never really sincerely believed a lot of these things, but I did get exposed to the cultures, the aesthetic, the philosophies, at least the facts about religion, which was never taught. It was only there's this one true faith, which is this whole racist Calvinist thing, and then everyone else is just going to burn in hell. So it was very good to have my mind open to, all the other things that was out there. Mormonism is not very, very big in South Africa, or at least it wasn't big around me in my time. So it never really featured, and I never really entered the church. When I finished high school, I was 18. I kind of became a gay activist, trying to, change the world for the better and stand up for the gays and the lesbians and whatever. And at that stage, I was a little older when I was so disillusioned with all the faiths, because I went everywhere looking for God, and all I saw was people. Don't get me wrong, there were beautiful, wonderful things in almost every faith. And at the same time, there was no such thing as a perfect faith. And I was just overwhelmed by the lack of anything true. So I kind of became anti-religious. By this stage, I did not believe in God. It wasn't that I was angry with God anymore. Buddhism helped me work through a lot of anger issues. But I just didn't believe that there was anything divine. I thought I was an atheist. I really didn't believe that there's anything other than this world. And this world's pretty cruel. So you got to stand up for yourself and, be an activist. But there's nothing more than this. As I became more involved as an activist, I became not just a non-believer, but an anti-believer. Because as far as I was concerned, whenever some gay person was being hurt, there was a guy with a Bible or a Quran or a Torah or a something not far behind. And so I became a student of religions on a different level, in that I wanted to expose myself to all the many things that would prove to me how evil and homophobic they all are. And it was in this context that I first picked up a Book of Mormon.
Gotcha. Okay. So had you, I'm curious too, what was your understanding of Mormonism before you picked up that Book of Mormon?
I was given a Book of Mormon by a missionary of the church who came here to South Africa. I don't want to mention her name. I don't want her to be in trouble for the stuff I say. But she was wonderful. And we always met in a public place because she explained this whole thing to me. But there were no male missionaries at that mission at that time or whatever the case may be. So we met in public, herself and some of the sisters, and she gave me a Book of Mormon.
Had you heard of Mormonism before? Had you seen missionaries before? What was your understanding of Mormonism before this meeting?
My understanding of Mormonism was that they were one of those homophobic groups.
Okay. So not too much depth other than this is one of many homophobic religions.
Were some weird sort of Christian denomination, and the word polygamy was somewhere there in the background.
Oh yeah, you got to have that in there, right?
That's it. That's what I knew, and well, I knew they were somewhere here. So I needed to approach them. I needed to get their scripture, and I needed to
even
that
in,
scripture.
Even in South Africa, we've got the reputation that precedes us, definitely.
I think I might have found that reputation online on American sites, though.
Okay.
Because as an activist, I was educating myself about what was going on in the gay world. So I wanted to know what was happening to gays and lesbians in Uganda, okay, in Mississippi, in Russia, in Australia, in Britain. For me, this was a big gay world and we needed to change things. So my studies might have led me online where I might have picked up something on polygamy. Mormonism was not known.
Okay.
It wasn't understood at all by me. And I wanted to mine it for every little bit of dirt I could find.
So you are looking in the Book of Mormon that you were given by a sister missionary in South Africa. You are mining it, as you say. You are looking for homophobic rhetoric and writing in the Book of Mormon. And what do you find?
I find nothing.
There's nothing.
I find nothing homophobic. But more than that, it took me a while to read the book. I mean, I was given the book, but I never actually read it. I just kind of, you know, put it on the shelf, and if I ever need to, I'll go back to it. You get tired being angry all the time. And so I put it on the shelf, and then eventually I picked it up, and I started reading it, wanting to mine it for this information. And at first I go, you know, this is probably going to be boring more than anything else. And then I kept reading it, and I kept reading it, and suddenly I found a God whose character I could respect. I found something I wanted to believe in, and the homophobia and the activism and all that stuff became secondary to me as I kept reading this book. And I read about 3 chapters a day. At the end of the book, there was this this reading chart. So once I started actually getting into it, I had this highlighter. And every time I finished a day, I would highlight that day. And I started watching those little highlights grow. And I read every night. And I read it, and I thought about it a lot. The sister missionary told me to read, ponder, and pray. It was easy to read. I've been reading for years. Pondering was pretty much what I did all the time, but praying was really hard for me because I didn't believe. And in this book, I found the closest thing I ever found to God, and still I couldn't pray. And it would feel ridiculous for me because on an intellectual level, this was okay. You know, I can cope with this religion. I could cope with this God. In fact, I wanted to believe in it, but I mean, I don't know if I can believe. But I kept going through it, and I'll never forget. Reading in Alma, where he says, "If you don't have faith and you want to have faith, how do you get faith?" I'm paraphrasing here.
Yeah.
But he said, "Experiment upon the words. Try a little and see what happens." Essentially, it boils down to that.
Plant the seed.
That's right. Do a little bit and see what happens. And if it works, then try some more. To me, this seemed infinitely reasonable. So I prayed and felt ridiculous the first couple of times. And then it became real for me. And then there was another piece in Alma not that many days later when I finally got back to it, because then it kind of threw me. I mean, I didn't know what was going down at that stage. I mean, but I went back to the book, and then there was this this piece where Alma says, "This is the hour of your conversion." I know that scripture very well. It said, "This is the hour of your conversion." And it was at that stage that I began to pray without feeling ridiculous again. And it is from that day that I pray daily, and I study my scriptures, and I learn hymns, and I try as best as I can, from a background that is not very religious and not always very kosher, with a lot of anger and a lot of violence and a lot of sexual immorality in the life that I've led up to this point, I became changed. And that is why I self-identify as a Mormon. Now, I don't know if everyone will accept me as one, but quite frankly, I answer to the boss. When I'm on my knees, alone in my room, that spirit there is where my responsibility lies. If there is a church or a group of churches or a council or a quorum or a whoever, I could not care less. My faith has to do with that God that I met in that book.
Wow. I'm just overwhelmed by what you're saying here. So, first off, I would say, Peter, I definitely accept you as a Mormon and part of our faith. And that is an unbelievably inspiring story of your conversion and your testimony. So you, after reading the book and pondering and praying sincerely for maybe the first time in your life, really sincerely, you gain a testimony. Where does that lead you from there? What do you, as you experience a connection with Heavenly Father, with God?
I spoke to my father again for the first time in 10 years, and I've since healed that bridge. I see my father quite regularly. You know, he's still the old mean guy he always was, but I've reconciled with my family. I've cleaned up my act as much as possible. I've stopped being angry. It took a while, and I mean, there was so much anger that the Buddhism helped with and whatever, but I'm really at a spot where, listen, when I was 14, I get kicked out of home. I hate my father. I hate my mother. I hate the world. I hate my race. I hate my country. I hate my language. I hate myself. And I'll never really amount to anything, even though I'm fighting everyone. I'm 33 years old today. I write for a living. That was my dream. A dream so big that I didn't even allow myself to dream it for very long. I write for a living. It's what I do. I have a beautiful house. I have a large family. I am totally known as a gay person by everyone in my life and accepted as such. I mean, the tree indeed is known by the fruits. Everything in my life has changed since then. Everything in my life has changed since then. And I'm not saying this as some naive person who, you know, kind of grew up religious and kind of just gives a hollow testimony. I've walked on the wild side. I'm not saying this as someone who was indoctrinated from the start. I did not believe. So I've seen the change in almost everything. And I'm a joyful person. I have a lot of fun living. I enjoy what I do. I enjoy my life. I enjoy my friends, and my life is good. I am blessed abundantly. Wow.
So, I mean, the Book of Mormon for you is literally, it's a seed that you planted in your life. It is the way that you have built this relationship with God, but it also has led to this tree sprouting where you become a writer, you are living your dreams, you are working on reconciliation with your father. You said you have a family?
Well, my family. You know, when I left my father's house, I left them all. I left my sisters. I've got four sisters. I've got two on the mother's side, two on the father's side. Didn't see anyone for a long time.
Okay.
And when I started reconciling, suddenly my sisters are back in
your
my life.
Two of them are back. Your family is back in your life.
There we go. I've got godkids now on the sisters' sides. You know, they've got like offspring of their own. So they're all just becoming bigger. And there's all these people. I was solo. I was so solo before. And now suddenly I can call any one of my four sisters. I can call my dad if I had to. If I needed to, I could call him. Some days, just to chat.
So much goodness obviously has flown or sprouted and come from this experience in your life.
But that's what the book says, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what the book says. It says it time and time and time and time and time again. I mean, the thing about the Book of Mormon is that there are these recurring themes that you can follow. And that it is, if you are obedient to the commandments of God, you will be blessed. It's not as simple as a prosperity doctrine. You know, it's not as simple as, well, if you do right, then you will be blessed, and otherwise you're going to be punished. That's not the point of it. But it does say time and time again that in a way, it's just logical. If you gravitate towards things that are good, you're going to get more of it. You know, what you focus on, you get more of. So if you're going to be focusing on anger, well, then yes, you'll get more anger. If you're going to focus on lust, then you're going to get more lust. If you're going to focus on greed, then you're going to get more greed. But if you focus on compassion and kindness and understanding and love and wisdom and seeking after God's word, then you'll be rewarded by that, by getting more of that. And this is my religion.
What?
Don't know what it is. Don't know what others call it, but that's what I've got.
So after reading and receiving this testimony, did you make contact with that sister missionary again? Did you say, hey, what do I do now?
She went back, like I said, when I first got the book, I didn't read it immediately. So by the time all this happened, she was back back home. She went back to the States. And I'll never forget her, and I'll never forget her name.
You still keep contact with her?
But no. I understood that it would be weird for a male to keep contact with a female because, of course, things might happen between males and females, little do they know. So I didn't want to put her in a position where her loyalty to her mission or her church was questioned. So I was kind of abrupt in some ways, and I didn't contact. But you know, that off she went, and I haven't seen her since. I really think of her fondly though. So by the time this happened, she was out of town, and by the time this happened, I had to educate myself about the church. And in order to do that, I pretty much went online, and I read what I could find, and I realized that I would not be welcome in this church as an out, unashamed gay man. This is a problem for me because the Book of Mormon tells me that I must be baptized. And I have not been baptized in a way that I would consider legitimate. I was baptized as an infant. The last book in the Book of Mormon has some very specific things it says about infant baptism that I agree with. And I know that the book instructs me to be baptized, but I also know that I am, being as open as I am, I would not be welcome in the church. I also read about some of the political actions taken by the church, and I realized this was not in line with the spirit that I encountered in the scripture, and would not be a good thing for me to join this church at this stage. I wouldn't be welcome.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was donated by George Parkinson and Kelly Clark Parkinson.
Fear not, thou dear.